be rare. But conservatives, it seemed to me, at least way back in the Reagan years, even today, they talk about fiscal conservatism. They talk about being against government spending as if that's a horrible thing. And yet we have this president giving us the highest spending in American history, taking Clinton's $5 trillion surplus into a $5 trillion deficit, pork bills one right after the other, corporate tax breaks for Halliburton, drug companies, oil companies. How can you justify, or maybe you don't, maybe you can be consistent, but how can you justify the big spending under this administration?
It's a difficult thing to do.
Okay. Well, that's an honest response.
You know, he does have a legitimate excuse, which is that in the post-September 11th world, that the best thing he could do is pump a lot of money into the economy on the one hand, because a strong economy is our best defense against terrorism. And part two is to pump a lot into the military so we can go fight the guys. But I think that's more of an excuse than it is the legitimate situation. I think they've learned from Democrats that the best way to hold on to power is to, you talk about bribe the American people with lots of money flowing back into the economy.
Well, you know, I'm afraid I'm agreeing with you, and so that's always a dangerous thing on Election Tuesday. But I think you're right. I don't learn from the Democrats was a little insult out there, but no, I think you're right. I think they are doing that. But part of my problem is that it's not even working. They're putting all this huge gas in the economy, that massive government spending, massive tax cuts, again, debt as far as the eye can see. George Bush's proposals in the future actually are higher than Kerry's proposals. I mean, he talks about Kerry has $2 trillion in new spending. George Bush has $3 trillion in just his making tax cuts permanent proposal, and that's $1 trillion. Another $2 trillion in his idea to basically privatize Social Security. That's $3 trillion alone, not to mention his other plans. You know, do you think that the public's just not getting it, or do you think the conservatives are willing to overlook their dislike of big spending because they support Bush for other reasons?
Well, I think the American people have been taught, and Republicans are included in this, that a big government that gives them a lot is what they should have. So I think that Republicans and Democrats both can make all kinds of commitments in the campaign, as both of them are doing, that on the one hand they may try to do. On the other hand, we don't necessarily believe that much of what they say in a campaign anyway. And you know, what do you think George W. Bush is going to be like in a second term, if you imagine a second term?
Well,
I suspect he's going to pull back on anything expensive and try to tackle the fiscal issue, but that's not popular in an election year. John Kerry, as bizarre as some of his proposals are, I don't think he's going to pursue them when he gets into office.
You know, I mean, you basically sounds to me like you're just voting on hopeful thoughts. I mean, because here you have a president, and it's not just, you know, money to go to the war in Iraq, which I oppose, and not money for Homeland Security, which I support. And even not just his horrible tax cuts, which we can talk about, but just the amount of pork. There was a bill that just went through Congress a few months ago that I lambasted on air that gave money not just to oil companies and tobacco farmers, but people like bow and arrow manufacturers and makers of fish tackle boxes. I mean, it's laughable, except that this is really the law. Why do you think that Bush would cut back in a second term? Why wouldn't he continue to reward the people that give him money and finance his campaign?
Because right now it's helping to get reelected. The idea that all this money, see, ultimately the economy needed the boost. You mentioned earlier when we were talking about the amount of money the Bush administration has pumped into the economy. Imagine what would have happened post-September 11th. If it hadn't been for the huge federal spending that's been going on over the last 3 years. I mean, it's mind-boggling how much money the federal government has pumped into the economy. The economy is going okay, but it's not going gangbusters. Where would we be had we not made this investment that's, you know, reminiscent of Roosevelt pulling us out of the Depression with government spending?
Well, I'll tell you what I think the problem is. I'm curious to know from you first. Why do you think we have spent, as you say, like gangbusters, massive amounts of money, more than really ever before, and the economy is just limping along? I want to hear what you think, because I have a very strong reason, but I'm curious what yours is.
I don't have a clear handle on it.
Okay.
I think on the one hand, there was a legitimate blow to confidence on September 11th, but I'm not sure what the other hand is.
Well, here's my rationale, if you will, and I'd like to know if you agree. My rationale is that the tax cuts were so heavily weighted to the extreme wealthy that they just couldn't pump up the economy. And really, if you think about it logically, and you know, you don't have to have a degree in economics to think about it this way, you got a guy and he's got a car factory. Let's say he's the head of GM, all right? He's got a lot of car factories. And he makes, $70 million a year. I'm throwing these figures out hypothetically. And let's say we give this guy another $30 million. So now he makes $100 million a year. Now, Bush's policy suggests that the tax cuts targeted at the rich, they say, well, the rich give the jobs, and so he's going to open up a new factory. I don't see how I'll open up a new factory, because it seems to me if there's no demand for cars, he's just going to keep the $30 million, put in his pocket, maybe fly to Greece and have a private party.
Yeah, but what does his pocket consist of? You're assuming that the only way to pump money back into the economy is for each person to go out and buy hard goods.
What a wealthy
person does with cash is invested into equities, and those equities provide cash to companies to go do the kind of growing want them to be doing.
But they're getting
that money. The extra influx of cash is coming, but they have enough, their confidence damaged enough by the September 11th or by the war in Iraq, whatever it is, that even though they've got more capital to go invest, they're sitting and waiting. And that's been the excuse we've heard on the long tail that jobs have taken this year.
Well, see, I think that there may be some small push in the economy if there's more capital to companies. I don't think so, though, because, first of all, that rich person can invest all over the world, and often they do, to diversify their assets. And companies we've seen, even that have more equity, are sitting on the – because even if you're a company and you've got an extra $100 million there because Bush has lowered your corporate taxes or given you a tax break, if no one's buying your cars, why should you build another factory? You're sitting on the cash. You might give it back as a dividend to your shareholders. Bush, of course, has tried to make dividends also easier to give by lowering taxes on that.
But if you have confidence in the economy and you've got more cash to use, you might expand your advertising budget.
I don't think so.
Piece of equipment that would make you more efficient. You might add some employees. Did I say that already? There's a number of things you might do require you to feel some confidence that there's going to be cause and effect as a result of the investment.
Let me give an alternative solution. Instead of giving that company or that rich person $100 million and hope that they spend it on advertising to entice people who, after all, have seen their incomes fall, real incomes, year after year after year in the Bush administration.
Not in the Bush administration, on a long-term basis.
Oh, no, absolutely. Real incomes have fallen.
Back to the 1970s, what you see is that the average American has less for doing the same job.
That's true, but it's been pronounced. Of the last 3 years, we have seen real incomes after inflation, fall every single year in the Bush administration. You didn't see that in the Clinton administration. They went up.
Because Clinton came into office on an upswing, and Bush came into office on a downturn. So naturally, you wouldn't see that.
In 8 years, Clinton created 22 million jobs, and incomes went up. But let me just make my point and then come back at me. My point is this. If you take the $30 million or the $100 million and you split it up, let's say you take $100 million and you give, $10,000, let me get my math right, to 10,000 people. Now, you give it to ordinary citizens, people making the median, people making a little bit lower, a little bit higher than the average income. And they're working two jobs, as families often have to do these days. And let's say they can only afford one car, and they're splitting it, going to work. They got another $10,000 in their pockets. I think they're likely to buy that new car. And if they buy that new car, then enough people want cars. That's how capitalism works. That's how the economy works. They have to build new factories to accommodate the demand, to get more cars, and then they hire more workers. And to me, that makes the economy boom. It seems to me that $10,000 in the income of a middle-class American goes a lot farther than in the rich American, because the rich American doesn't need another car. And to me, it's very clear economically, totally apart from ideas of, maybe we should help the poor, help the middle class, totally apart from fairness ideas that liberals care about, if you're a pure capitalist and you just want the economy to run well, don't you think, Todd, that someone earning $50,000 a year is more likely to spend that extra $10,000 than someone earning $500,000 a year?
Yeah, I would be inclined to agree, although I'd love to see the real numbers crunch someday and to see what happens, what the paper trail is to the dollar that goes to the rich person who puts it into an equity, which goes into the pocket of a capitalist. But my instinct would tell me if you could get $10,000 in the hands of somebody who makes $50,000 a year, of course they would never pay that much in taxes, because the average American family doesn't pay federal income taxes in this country. But yeah, my instinct would be to agree with you.
Well, the average pays less. I won't say that the average doesn't pay anything at all. That's not true.
The average family of four does not pay federal income taxes from the stats I've seen.
Okay. I saw it was 28,000 and under, but I don't know that I'm working on a family for four, so.
No, that would be a single, but a family, the average right. family of four makes somewhere in the low 40s and pays zero federal income taxes. So to give them a $10,000 rebate means not a tax cut, but a new social program, which, you know, would be a whole different thing to propose.
Well, it's not really a new social program. If you look under Bill Clinton, the middle class tax burden was lower than it is under George Bush. The middle class was paying a smaller percentage of income tax than they are now under Bush. And so, you know, all you have to do is skew the tax cut, much as Kerry's proposing. Kerry proposes a tax cut for 98% of Americans, all of those that earn under 200-something thousand a year. And, yes, it'd be an increase on the top 2%. Now, I mean, are you against this proposal?
I am for anything that reduces overall tax burden first, and I'm for something that increases fairness of taxes. And what's really underlying, I think, what the Bush administration is doing is not a first-hand desire to pump up the economy, because I think he had these tax cuts in mind even before there was a recession. I think his desire was to make a tax code that was less burdensome on the wealthy. And I have no problem with that. I'm all for reducing the size of government, and the only way to effectively do it is to take away the ability to endlessly tax.
Well, but Bush hasn't reduced the size of government, even though he has decreased the tax burden on the wealthy. I mean, what's interesting about arguing with you, Todd, is that we agree so much. A lot of times on this election Tuesday, and my callers can attest to this, and by the way, if you want to call in, I welcome you to do that. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Most of the time I get people disagreeing with me on my premise, and we never actually get to the conclusion. You, I think, agree with me on my premises that Bush wanted to cut taxes for the wealthy, but you actually think that's a good idea and that somehow it will decrease government. I haven't seen it decrease government.
Well, we've already discussed that and why it hasn't. It's because Bush is getting a little bit of everything here. He's giving the tax cut to the wealthy, and he's giving a big tax cut across the board, saying, look, I want smaller government. It's much better to have this money in the hands of the people. If taxes are lower, that's a better thing. I agree with that on an instinctive basis. I lived for a couple of years being in radio. You know, you travel around a bit. And I lived for a couple of years in New Hampshire. It's just a fascinating state to see the structure of their government. And to me, it's a structure that recognizes human nature. And I'm always looking to take truths of human nature and inject them into large bureaucracies, because large bureaucracies are automatically inefficient and destructive to our better instincts. And they understand this in New Hampshire. They've got this beautiful tax system where there are no, there are fewer of these incremental taxes, which, you know, like income tax and sales taxes, both of which they don't have in New Hampshire on a statewide basis. Those things are insidious, you know, once you have a percentage tax that's coming out of somebody's paycheck every week, and they don't even know how much they pay in federal taxes and in state taxes each year, and you say to them, oh, guess what, you know, it would only cost you another $13 a week and we could provide this wonderful service. Well, you know, human beings being the good-natured things that they are, I'll say, oh, okay, you know, more people are going to have food on their table, and it only costs me $13 a week, I can do that. And the trouble with that is that it just grows and grows and grows and grows, and people don't see the cause and effect. New Hampshire has this system where everything is pretty much based on real dollars coming out of real people's pockets, and the result of that is that they watch every penny being spent. So they have a state legislature where the legislators make $100 a year. They're basically volunteers. And guess what? They have plenty of very good state legislatures in New Hampshire, the legislators. And guess what else they do? They've never air-conditioned the state house. So these guys stay away in the summer, and they're not there on a full-time basis. And guess what? They have plenty of laws, and they seem to run along just fine. Other states, like Massachusetts right nearby, adjacent state, pays $50,000 a year plus to be a state legislator. What is Massachusetts getting that New Hampshire doesn't get? I don't understand.
Well, you know,
they've got big staffs here in New Hampshire. They don't even have an office, a state legislator, unless he belongs to a committee that has an office, and then he can borrow the phone. You know, it's creating the pressure on the other side that you need to have a system run fairly. We all know about, you've talked about all the pork. How does that pork happen? It happens because no one knows what these guys do once we send them down there to make their $150,000 a year and have their multi-million dollar budgets. They go, look at the John Kerry, who's been, I live in Massachusetts, 20 years he's been in the U.S. Senate. You can ask anyone in this state, anything John Kerry's done, they have no idea.
Well, part of the problem, I think, is John Kerry's not very good at publicizing what he's done, and he should, and he doesn't do that very well. But, you know, what you're saying about state government, I'm not in New Hampshire. I'm not in Massachusetts. I can't argue with you. It's just interesting that we agree so much on the federal budget, and you seem to agree with me that George Bush is absolutely no fiscal conservative. One of the things that Kerry did do in the Congress, in fact, was he worked to do a balanced budget. He actually broke with a lot of Democrats in the mid-90s with Bill Clinton to support a balanced budget, and his spending in the future is less than what Bush proposes. So it just sounds to me like you're going on faith, but I do want to go to one of our callers and see what he or she has to say. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Todd Feinberg.
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hi, Gordon. What's your question for Todd or for me?
Well, you guys are just way too tame today.
We're agreeing too much.
Well, maybe if Todd tells us why George Bush is strong on the war on terror, we can get you guys talking.
All right. Well, that's a good question. And Todd, it's actually where I want to go.
I just want to find out one thing first. Is it snowing in Michigan yet?
Pardon me?
Is it snowing in Michigan yet?
Not just yet.
A couple more weeks, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, it's a question for you. We have the report by the 9/11 Commission talks about Afghanistan, a country that really we haven't talked much about. And it says in the report, since 9/11, Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters have regrouped. Warlords control most of the country beyond Kabul. Economic development is a distant hope. The narcotics trade is again booming. The report mentions that we spent $1.6 billion in Afghanistan for an entire year compared to $100 billion going to Iraq, so 100 times that in Iraq. There's 140,000 troops in Iraq, 20,000 in Afghanistan, so 7 times the troops in Iraq. I guess my question is, in fighting the war against terrorism, do you really feel that Afghanistan is much less of a threat than Iraq to the United States?
Well, a threat from what realm do you mean? Which direction are you talking about? I mean, there's so many different layers you can look at threat.
Well, I mean, in terms of a threat to American lives, I mean, a threat to citizens
right
at home.
Afghanistan represents a very small threat because we got rid of the Taliban, and the Taliban was allowing Al-Qaeda to operate freely in their country. So we got rid of the Taliban.
Well, but no, we didn't. That's exactly what the 9/11 report says. The Taliban has regrouped. Yes, we got rid of them in the capital. They're not in Kabul anymore.
They're no longer running the country, and that puts
sure
us in a better position. Have we, from day one, I don't think we've been aggressive enough in that country. I'll agree with you on that.
Well, but you say they're not running the country. They're not running the capital, but they're certainly running the countryside. I mean, again, this is my source of the 9/11 report. It's also we've had Afghani woman on the show who talked about it as well. They are coming back largely because we're focusing on Iraq instead of Afghanistan. And I guess my question is, how does that help us in the war on terror?
Well, I think the war in Iraq ultimately helps us in the war on terror. It would be better if we were doing a better job in Afghanistan. And I felt that way even before we went into Iraq. I don't think we were being aggressive enough in Afghanistan.
Well, we're agreeing.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. It's just we're screwing up both of them.
Well,
do you think Al-Qaeda is still a threat?
Do you think Al-Qaeda is still a factor, Todd?
I think Al-Qaeda is much less of a factor. These guys are, I think, always going to be amongst us to some degree. The idea that Looney Tunes are going to like the idea of vandalizing the modern world, and it's such an easy thing to do. The question is, are you going to have Looney Tunes like Reed, who failed to light the match to light the bomb in his sneaker on the airliner, or are you going to have a well-organized, well-funded, orchestrated effort like September 11th was? And I think we've clearly impacted dramatically their ability to pull off the ladder.
Gordon, I want to thank you for your call.
Okay.
Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Todd Feinberg. What's your name? Where are you from?
Oh, gentlemen, my name is Dave, and I'm out here on the West Coast, and I appreciate the civility that both of you show.
Well, we're agreeing.
Give us five.
Give you five?
Give us time.
Give us time. We're agreeing too much now.
My personal opinion is that the motivations behind the current administration are not noble in the least degree. I've come more and more to believe that it's a planned feudalism, that the very greedy special interests that put the Bush team in the White House did so with some serious expectations that are being delivered. It involves a massive shift of wealth from the middle class and the working people, the poor, into the pockets of the very wealthiest of corporate interests.
You know, Dave, what interests me is that it doesn't sound like Todd disagrees with you. I don't know, Todd.
Well, I certainly disagree with that.
All right.
I think one of the great misconceptions that's been pushed onto the people over the last couple of years is this whole Michael Moore, Al Franken, Whoopi Goldberg mentality, that there is something so insidious and evil with Bush in the White House that everybody has an obligation to go vote him out of office because every policy is so bizarre and everything is so misguided and all intentions are so malicious. I think to get a better handle on this election, you have to let go of the desire to feel that way.
Well,
it's not a constructive way to view what's going on in office, because what happens is both sides are doing this now. Okay, you guys are all fired up about how George W. Bush is the most evil, irresponsible thing that's ever happened, and the Republicans are doing the same thing in return on John Kerry, who, you know, he went to war, but he doesn't get any credit for going to war because he's been so inconsistent with some of the statements he's made since he was there, and it just feeds this ridiculous approach we have to politics that doesn't have to do with looking at anything like it's reasonable.
But Todd,
you know, John Kerry is a reasonable guy. I don't want him to be president, that's all.
Well,
but he's a reasonable man.
I appreciate that. But I don't think Dave's point was that Bush was being unreasonable. Maybe it was. I think his point was...
No, he described a big conspiracy here to destroy the economic balance in the country.
Well, you say
conspiracy. I'll be very clear on that, if you'd like. I'm of the belief that reality can be at times very ugly, and presently it is that, and I look at reality for what it is. I see a planned intent to diminish the middle class. I see a planned intent to...
What would be the goal in doing that? I mean, what would be the purpose in diminishing the middle class?
Okay, I'll explain it, if you will, because if you hold wages to a minimum and have a big surplus of low-wage people competing with one another to work, it allows the profit makers to grab a whole hell of a lot more.
And what's your evidence for this? Is this the passing of NAFTA and the globalization, which is really what when people talk about jobs flowing overseas, this is the liberal dream what we're having right now. We're using the economic power of the United States of America, not just for the benefit of our own population anymore. We are now exporting that and saying to these other countries, look, you can have a piece of the action too. You modernize, you get your governments in line with the international standards and monetary standards, and that will allow our dollars to flow to you. Now, what happens when these dollars flow? So do the jobs, because those countries don't live by the same standards yet. We know that. We knew that going in. The jobs were going to be flowing overseas. The manufacturing was going to leave this country, was going to continue to leave this country, and the result of that was going to be we're going to have lower-paying jobs. This is your dream. Why are you objecting?
Well, Todd, I can't tell whether it's your dream or whether it's Dave's
dream.
This
is a liberal panacea. Use the power of the U.S. to lift up all the poor of the world.
Are you supporting outsourcing? Is that basically what you're saying?
I'm saying it's inevitable if you're going to have this globalized era continue. If we want to become isolationist, which I don't think we can, then we can stop the outsourcing.
Well, what...
But ultimately, this is built on the idea that once those other economies, and we're seeing the benefit of it, once those other economies start modernizing, that we benefit because those dollars start flowing back. And we see huge amounts of money coming from China now that the Chinese are getting affluent. You know, you've got to... Their largest population on the planet, between them and India, as they start to get affluence, where are those dollars going to go? They're going to go out to the rest of the world to buy.
Well, my view is that outsourcing, I wouldn't prohibit it, but I definitely wouldn't encourage it with the tax breaks that George Bush is giving. But, Dave, I'll give you one last quick word, and then we got to go to commercial break.
Well, I think 600 of our pennies go to China for every one that's going to be coming back. I am convinced that if the plan is to hold wages down, impose minimum wage boosts, cut time in half, before the minimum of benefits, that's favoring a corporatist class of people at the expense of the working people of this country, the normal people.
But then you lose your market here. I don't understand. If you make everybody poor here, who do you sell to?
You know what? I've got to go to break. Tell you what, Dave, why don't you hang on, and we're going to continue this conversation right after the break, okay?
Give it a try.
If you want to join in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can just comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back this Election Tuesday right after this.
In the year 2000, the Democrats won the election, but Bush and the Republicans couldn't take the rejection. They counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election.
If you're an architect, if you do legal work or tax preparation, if you're an editor or radiologist, say bye-bye to your professional position. For CEOs are putting these and many more on a virtual boat overseas, with about 80% of the jobs going to India, where they can get the work done for a third or less than they pay to us Americans. The report, prepared by Forrester Research, says that offshoring is increasing dramatically. Forrester's previous prediction was that the U.S. would lose 588,000 jobs to offshoring by the end of this year. Now it estimates that 830,000 will be lost, a 41% increase. Nearly half of corporations surveyed say they're either offshoring jobs now or preparing to. Well, says one offshoring specialist, so what? Quote, it's free enterprise. We're trying to make money. Yeah, and so are bank robbers. This is Jim Hightower saying, the proper word for what these CEOs are doing is not offshoring, it's stealing. They're stealing America's middle-class future.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We had a little technical problem there, but it should be all fixed. My guest is Todd Feinberg. He is the host of the Todd Feinberg Show, which you can find at toddtog.com. He's a conservative radio host, but a reasonable one. In fact, so reasonable that I'm agreeing far more often than I usually do this Election Tuesday. But now he's defending outsourcing, at least I think he is. He's calling it, he says it's something that liberals should defend. And I got a caller on the line, Dave from California, who's challenging him on that. And if you want to call in and challenge Todd or challenge me, all you have to do is pick up the phone and dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. So let's go back to outsourcing. Now, Dave, why don't you go ahead? You were pointing out that the Bush administration really seems to not be too fond of the middle class. They've cut overtime, we know that, which I find extraordinary. They've increased the middle class tax burden. The average American wage has been going down, real income one after the other. Did you have some other points to make, Dave?
Well, I think it's been a planned coup that this cartel has pulled off to the detriment of the citizens of this country. It is a massive grab of the wealth and shift it to the very richest, who have almost no limit upon their greed. Todd and I have spoken separately, and he believes in maintaining a large middle class, that's what it's all about. But it's very vulnerable right now. I fear that if there were a continuation of the present administration, that middle class will be eaten alive, and people will be asked to believe in blind faith that our good president and his people have nothing to do with that. But
Let me ask you this. I don't necessarily share as much of a conspiracy theory as Dave. I do think that this administration is out to help its political allies. I don't know that it's a grand scheme to destroy the middle class. But whether or not it's intentional or not, don't you see how Bush's policies have been very harmful to middle America?
No, I don't. You'll have to explain it to me.
Well, just real incomes going down, that people having to work harder just to stay in the same place. We have Medicare premiums
during an economic downturn. And as I mentioned, you're talking about a trend that is a long-term trend going on over several decades.
Well, it didn't happen in the Clinton years. It didn't happen in the 90s. And
there was an economic upturn of dramatic proportion.
Right, but see, these upturns and downturns, to me, it's not like the weather. It's not like, oh, here comes a hurricane, here comes an economic downturn, let's just bunker it down and weather it. There are reasons why policies work and why policies don't work. I remember back in 1993 when Clinton proposed a tax increase to help fix the deficit, and the Wall Street Journal had an editorial predicting a huge recession we were going to have based on the Clinton tax plan in 1993. Instead, it led to the greatest expansion in American history. And here we have the government spending as much as they possibly can, and why is it that the Bush administration has lost jobs? No president has lost jobs since Herbert Hoover, since the Depression. How do you explain that, Todd?
Well, I explained that he came into office with the beginning of a recession, and we got hit with September 11th. And if you look at the potential downside of September 11th, it's really a remarkable testament to our economy that we're in as good shape as we are, and I think also to the amount of money that the Bush administration pumped in. It's immediate protection of the airlines and an attempt to make sure that the American people didn't get overly cautious and scared into not spending money.
See, I don't see September 11th as an economic problem at all. Clearly, it's a major problem in terms of our security. But if you look at the history of the United States, war helps the economy. A lot of people don't know whether FDR's New Deal would have worked, but clearly World War II helped the economy. The Korean War helped the economy. Interestingly, the only war that didn't help the economy is Vietnam, and I would suggest the reason for that is because Vietnam wasn't paid for. FDR raised taxes during World War II to pay for all the extra government spending. The same is true during the Korean War. In Vietnam, Johnson didn't want people to really recognize the real hardships of this war, and so he didn't raise taxes, and I would argue that led to the huge stagflation and bad times in the 1970s when we paid back all this enormous money we borrowed. And that I would say that's the problem with Bush's plan. It's much more like Lyndon Johnson's than it is like FDR's.
I think it's hard to compare. There's so many variables. I mean, you go back to World War II and what happened after World War II and how this country was just ripe for economic explosion. They're just such complex comparisons. I think it's oversimplifying it.
Well, you could say it's oversimplifying it, but still we have the worst since Herbert Hoover. And, as bad as September 11th was, I don't see it as an event of the size of the Depression.
It's not. But what it was an event designed to have economic impact. That's what these kinds of events do. And the way you weaken a country with an attack like that is by the economic fallout, and not from anything else. I mean, 3,000 dead Americans doesn't change the course of this country in any measurable way. But if it leads to economic downturn, then that impacts the whole world.
Dave, I want to thank you very much for your call.
Okay, I wanted to let you know I left on your blog for today my personal professional observation of the two sides of the talk show.
Okay.
I found Todd an exception to it.
Well, actually, I did read that, and I'd like to address that with Todd. Let me get to another caller, and then we'll do that a little bit later in the hour. Thanks for calling, Dave. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Todd Feinberg.
Hi. Ed from New Jersey.
Hello, Ed from New Jersey. Todd, this is one of my conservative listeners. See, I do have a few of them.
You do? This is very exciting. Hey, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
So you're probably going to challenge me, huh, Ed?
He's probably going
after me.
Well, I don't know. We'll find out.
I just wanted to make a general comment on how I think the two key things on the election, I think the Democrats are depending on two things. One, that the perception of the war in Iraq is that it's disastrous. And the other thing is that the economic downturn was George Bush's fault. And I think to the extent that George Bush leads in the poll, it's to the extent that the American people don't agree with either one of those.
Oh, I think it goes much deeper, though, Ed. You know, and this is something that really struck me during the Republican convention after having seen the Democrat convention, was that there's such a constant buzz out there in the marketplace of ideas about how out-of-step Republicans are, and Bush in particular, about how bizarre these people are. And then you watch the Democratic convention, and you watch the Republican convention, and you realize afterwards, guess what? The Republicans are much more in line with what mainstream America feels about where this country is and where it should be going. Don't you think that's an element of it?
Or at the very least, the Republicans are much more confident in who they are compared to the Democrats.
The Republicans, it seems to me, their convention was putting emotion over facts. I mean, it's just like Todd said originally. He said people like a lot of spending because it feels good. It's the same reason people run up huge debts on their credit card and then, oh my God, they have to pay it back. The Republicans ran on emotion, and they ran really on a lie. And it goes back to what you said, Ed, that Iraq is some tremendous success. Again, our president called it a catastrophic success. I don't know quite what that means. But right now we have an Iraq. We just heard today, we are withdrawing. We are letting al-Sadr and the terrorists, who George Bush said he was going to fight to the end, we're letting them take over huge swaths of territory. We're actually doing in Iraq what we did in Afghanistan, bunkering down, protecting our troops in the capital, and allowing the country to go to lawlessness. And that's not going to be discussed. No, at the Republican National Convention, it's all September 11th, and wasn't Bush glorious, and Iraq and Afghanistan are free. But that's just not the facts on the ground. So to me, what the Republican convention showed is that, yes, you can successfully lie to people. And that's
sad. Well, no, you're missing, I think, what the bigger message is. I mean, let's be honest, all right? They're both advertising events. They are TV shows. And there's a lot of theater and a lot of our money spent to create all the backdrops and all the ambience for them to put on a good TV show. That being a given, that both of them are marketing campaigns, What I saw happen was the Republicans demonstrate themselves to be much more viscerally in touch with the American people. And that's why you see John Kerry where he is right now. He misunderstood the American people in designing that convention. He misunderstood the politics of the time. And as a result, he's behind.
You know, I'm not going to disagree with you too much. I will agree that Republicans are better marketers. The last Democrat we had that was this good actually was much better. It was Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton would beat Bush 60-40, if not 65-35, because he was someone who did very much, you're right, understand middle Americans. And I think that the Bush people are. They're definitely marketing this feel-good stuff. I don't think it reflects truth. But you're absolutely right. John Kerry decided to do a positive message. He went into the Democratic convention. He said, now everyone has to be positive. You got to be on your best behavior. We don't want to do a negative campaign. We're hardly going to mention Bush. And I've argued on this show that is exactly the wrong strategy to go. This is a referendum on the incumbent. The question is, has he done a good job? And I think the American people realize he hasn't. But they need to hear Democrats saying that. So in that,
John Kerry's run a terrible campaign. Part of that terrible campaign was going into that convention and doing the salute, as if the salute was going to be the big signal to everybody who's a knee-jerk supporter of the military and to get tough international policy, that he was the guy to run the country. And he deliberately did not raise any argument for why he should be president. What he was counting on was that somehow the Whoopi Goldberg, Al Franken thing was going to carry the day, that America was going to be so disdainful of our president that he just had to stand there and remind them that he was going to be okay on defense, and he would ride a wave of Bush hatred into office. And that was a gross miscalculation.
Well, what strikes me is, in my opinion, that the lack of credibility when the Democrats use far too many superlatives in saying that Iraq is the worst disaster, and that
they didn't say that. Who said that?
You know, all the time they say Bush lost more jobs than Herbert Hoover. You know, and neither time acknowledging that. Well, maybe the reason for the loss of jobs happens to do with 9/11, which were events outside of George Bush's control. Every time they do that, I think they, you know, if they gave a more tempered statement that George Bush hasn't helped the economy, you know,
no, but,
even
but
though
it's a
even
fact.
Though some of it's not his fault. If they gave a more tempered statement, I think there'd be credibility. But it just reminds me of the Saturday Night Live skit where Al Gore is on there saying that George Bush is the worst president, even worse than Hitler.
I don't remember Al Gore saying that even in a Saturday Night Live episode. But Ed, look,
it was a spoof of Al Gore. I agree he didn't say that.
It is a fact, Ed, that every single president since Herbert Hoover has created jobs in office until this one.
I agree with that.
All right, it's a fact.
But when you don't acknowledge that some of the reason for the loss
it was
of jobs
in September 11th.
Is George
look,
Bush's control,
look.
And that had it been a Democratic president, there also would have been a high loss of jobs.
Look,
when you
we
don't
have
temper it with a certain you know, gravity.
And September 11th didn't
you know
do
what?
That.
When 9/11 occurred, the economic went downturn, and it has nothing to do with George Bush, and that 9/11 attack could have just as easily happened under a Democratic president as well as a Republican.
Let me deal with something first of all that I think you're both dead wrong about, and that is that 9/11 had this tremendous, horrible impact on the economy. Let's just deal with the facts, all right? The recession began in March 2001, long before September 11th, okay? We were starting to come out of it in September, and then it took two more months, and then we came out of it in November. This country has undergone a lot worse than September 11th. You just look at the Jimmy Carter years of the high inflation and the high oil shocks. Look at our fighting the Cold War. Look at the Korean War. Look at the Vietnam War. There's a lot more that this country has undergone economically than September 11th. I'm not saying it was great for the economy, but it mostly affected New York City. That's the main place it focused on. I didn't say it helped the economy, but to say that this is the excuse why this is the first president since Herbert Hoover not to create jobs, you're really, I think, putting the cart before the horse. You're really making 9/11 this huge excuse that I don't think it is.
Well, first of all, you said it March of 2001. So what did George Bush do between January and March that caused
I'll tell
the
you what he did.
Start?
From the minute that he was selected in December, he started talking down the economy. In fact, he did some of it even before he was selected. If you look back in November, December of 2000, okay, you hear the president say the economy is failing. The economy is failing.
Talking down the economy right now.
Well, the economy's not doing well right now, but Bush was talking down the economy when it was doing well.
Bush was doing that back in December
2000. I think the same reason why he won't debate John Kerry, it's to lower expectations. The whole purpose of that was to say, well, we need a tax cut.
Of course it was, but it was also true, Mark.
No, but it's also true that when the President of the United States, okay, says the economy is going horribly, all right? People believe that. People invest upon it. People expect their policies. No, I'm talking about after he was selected, back in December.
November when he got elected to March, you're saying that his negative comments on the economy caused the recession?
It's not just that. It's also his policies. People understand that when you transfer money
between that time.
No, but he had advocated policies. People knew he was going to do this massive tax cut that would lead to a huge deficit, all right? And people weren't investing the way they were. Well, why not? It's what he said he's going to do in the campaign, and then he went ahead and
did it. Nobody knew there were going to be large deficits. They didn't even know the Clinton recession was starting.
You could plot a graph of the economic recovery to a graph of when tax cuts kicked in.
No, actually, you can't. Because, the tax cuts, and let's talk about one other reason why they're really awful. Back in, and I remember this very well because I was working in Congress at the time, back in 2001, 2002, the Democrats supported tax cuts too to get us out of the economy. But they supported temporary tax cuts. The idea was you infuse a lot of money into the economy right away just for a couple years to give us that kickstart, get us out of the economic depression, and then we can move on our way. The Republicans were against that. Bush said no. He actually wanted less in the first year than the Democrats wanted, which was, of course, the basic economic thing. He wanted these long-term structural deficits. And he didn't want money going to the middle class and the poor. They got very little. He wanted to cut the estate taxes so that people who inherit hundreds of millions would be better off. He wanted to cut dividend taxes so that people who invest a lot of money would be better off. But the ordinary American hardly saw any of it. I remember when Bernie Sanders, our only socialist member of Congress of Vermont, proposed that every American get $300, and Bush adamantly opposed it, and then eventually saw that it was a popular idea and accepted it and claimed it as his own. This was a Democratic idea, but if other than the $300, when you focus so much money, it's like Bush wanting to make these tax cuts permanent. These are huge structural deficit problems, and people know that you can't invest a lot in the economy when you got to pay it back.
Well, let me ask you this, Mark. Do you think there is a rate that of an income tax rate that should never be exceeded by the federal government?
Yeah, I do. But it ain't 28%, and it ain't 38%. Back when it was 90%, I can see how that would have harmed the economy. I think Kennedy lowered it from 90 to 70%, if I'm correct, and then it was later lowered from 70 to 50%. I think 50% is might be a reasonable number. But it seems to me that the taxes that lower middle class people pay, Social Security taxes, for example, as we all know, there's a cap at $80,000+. That means that if you're poor and you're middle class, you pay a much larger percent of your income in Social Security taxes than if you're extremely wealthy. It's a regressive tax. If you'd cut that tax, I think you would have seen a lot more economic growth.
Well, I'm all for cutting that tax too.
Well, that's good. That's good. I appreciate that. Ed, one last comment.
Nothing more. Thanks for the time.
Nothing
Thank
more.
Thank you, Ed.
Okay, we have to go to one more commercial break. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. We're discussing Bush and Kerry, and I have to agree with Todd. I don't think Kerry's run the best campaign, but it's clear to me that as a leader, Bush has done a much worse job than John Kerry would do. But hey, that's what Election Tuesday is all about. If you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back after this.
That Saddam was captured, hiding in a hole just like a rat would. Now they're saying that the war went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction?
If you think that the Bushites had no post-war plan for what they would do in Iraq after our military ousted Saddam, think again. You can see their plan in the extremist economic policies that were quietly and autocratically imposed on the Iraqi people during the reign of L. Paul Bremer III, who was our occupying czar there. While America's media establishment has been focused on the raging war by Iraqi insurgents and by the Bushites' attempt to enthrone a puppet government there, the neocon laissez-faire zealots in the administration have been gleefully using this ravaged country as their own ideological playground. For years, these Ayn Randian theorists have longed to create their utopia of a corporate state, and they've used the IMF, World Bank, WTO, and other monkey wrenches to try to implement their theories in Latin America and elsewhere. But they've never had an entire economy at their disposal until they grabbed Iraq. While Baghdad was burning, Bremer arrived. Rather than putting out the fires, he used them as a distraction to issue decrees that instantly opened up Iraq to a total corporate takeover. For example, his decrees open up all of that nation's public assets to foreign corporate ownership, and they allow 100% of the country's industries, from banking to food, to be owned by foreigners. Also, Bremer ruled that 100% of the profits that foreign investors make in Iraq can now be hauled out of the country. There's no requirement that any of these profits be reinvested there, nor that the investors have to pay even a dime in taxes on the profits they haul away. This isn't liberation, as the Bushites call their Iraqi adventure. It's legalized looting, and is fueling the continuing anger and armed resistance by the Iraqi people, who are determined not to have their nation looted. This is Jim Hightower saying, to get this full story, see Naomi Klein's explosive article in Harper's Magazine. You can read it at harpers.org.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Hello from the road, folks. You know, the only thing better than a twofer is a threefer. That's why this fall I'm staying at Econo Lodge and Roadway Inn Hotels. See, I get triple Southwest Airlines Rapid Rewards credit every time. So I earn flights three times faster. Call 800-4-CHOICE or visit choicehotels.com. We'll see you there.
Offer good for qualifying stays in the U.S. before November 30th, 2004. For details, visit choicehotels.com. Triple credit means 1.5 credits instead of the standard 0.5.
When the GOP is leaving, I hope that they don't hit their heads.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. This Election Tuesday, that's what the special music is all about. And my guest is Todd Feinberg, conservative talk show host. You can find out more about him at www.toddtalk.com. He's on the air in Boston and some 50 radio stations, and he kindly invited me on his show. And so now I'm returning the favor, and we just got a few minutes left. And I guess, Todd, I want to ask you about certain Bush policies and find out what you think about them. What about the Bush Medicare bill? Did you support it or against it?
I thought it was horrendous.
Okay, we agree on that. All right. How about the environment? How about the idea to cut the Clinton proposal to reduce arsenic in water, oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, opposing caps and carbon dioxide? How do you feel about Bush's environmental policies?
I think he's had a fairly balanced policy, but I have to admit I'm not one who's overly concerned about the environment.
Okay. How about guns? Bush has taken no effort to stop the assault ban from ending just yesterday, and now you can go out and buy yourself an AK-47 with a grenade launcher. That's one of the things that you can now buy is a grenade launcher. I don't really see the need of Americans to have grenade launchers. How do you feel about that issue, Todd?
I have been frustrated for 10 years about how difficult it's been to get a grenade launcher.
You wanted your own grenade launcher, huh, Todd?
It would round out my collection a little bit.
Well, you know, I guess I understand that. You know, it strikes me, Todd, you're a host. You're based in Massachusetts, probably the most liberal state in the United States. I don't know. Rhode Island may be close. And you're a conservative. I mean, are there these group of conservatives in Massachusetts that are sitting there just frustrated by living in such a liberal state?
I don't know that it's as liberal as it's perceived to be. It's very democratic.
Okay.
And as a result, Democrats get elected time after time. You know, all our federal office holders are Democrats.
Right.
And the state house is totally dominated by a Democratic legislature, which is veto-proof. So as a token, voters are in the habit now of putting a Republican in the corner office, which is largely ineffective because the legislature can do whatever it wants anyway. But I think it's more because you have a lot of working class people here who have historically their families have voted for Democrats, and that's just a hard habit for them to break, even when evidence is that it's not in your best interest to have a monolithic government.
Well, actually, I can agree with you that monolithic government's usually not a good idea. That's one reason why I'm advocating people. Well, obviously, I'm a Democrat, so I want to see Democrats elected. But even if you're in the middle, I think that you can agree that in the federal government, it's not good to have one party control the executive branch, both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court.
Well, we're not even talking control here. We're talking about there are virtually no Democrats in the no Republicans in the Massachusetts legislature. And that's not just a problem because they can pass whatever they want, but there aren't conversations, you know?
And, no, I understand.
And it's about having conflict and debate and floating different ideas and figuring out what the best one is, and those conversations don't take place. Same thing in New Hampshire, just in the other direction, equally problematic. It's virtually 100% Republicans, and it's not a constructive situation.
And Todd, it's the same thing at the federal level. We see here a House of Representatives where the Republicans don't even talk with the Democrats. They don't even show them the bill before they vote on it. They get about 2 hours to read some 700-page bill. A lot of times they get maybe a half hour of debate, and then they pass in the middle of the night, and they don't allow Democrats to do amendments.
Well, I don't understand why anybody votes on those bills. You know, I would take the whole contingency outside and sit on the front steps and do a photo op and say we're not voting on this legislation because they wouldn't let us see it before the vote. You know,
they did that once. I remember when they did that once.
All this Democratic-Republican hatred is that they are all endorsing and supporting the same corrupt system. And you can sit there all day long and talk about how corrupt George W. Bush is and how he's taking care of all these rich companies. And the Democrats are doing the same thing. There may be incremental differences. They may be protecting different industries. They all depend on money that doesn't come from you and me. And that's
but that's why at least we Democrats and a few Republicans supported the McCain-Feingold. The idea was to take money out of the system. And while I'll be the first to say it hasn't completely done the job, it's a first step. Why are the, I mean, if you're talking about campaign finance reform, let me ask you this, Todd. Do you agree with public financing of elections? Because it's something that I very much support. Take private money out of it.
I think there's a, you know, it's hard for me. Instinctively, it goes against my grain to have government doing anything it doesn't have to. But I'm feeling that there's no other way to fix our system. I think the biggest problem we have, and this is why, as a conservative, I voted for Ralph Nader 4 years ago.
Interesting.
I think the biggest problem we have in this country is that the government doesn't belong to us anymore. And as long as everybody is stuck in this game of toggle politics, of hating the other side like it's the Yankees and the Red Sox, then we're never going to face up to what the real problem is, and that is that we don't have a government anymore.
Well, Todd, I got to say, I agree with you. I think that is the problem, but part of my problem is that when we try to be good, and I think the Democrats made every effort in their convention, and maybe that's why you thought there wasn't enough there, but they made every effort to be nice, to not, there was very little Bush hating going on, and wherever they saw it, they tried to stamp it out, even though obviously a lot of Democrats are not too fond of this president, and then they're hit with the smear campaign and the Swift Boat ads and Zell Miller saying we're traitors if we dissent. You know, it seems to me that if you try to run a positive campaign, that would be very nice if the other side did. But when you run positive and you hit negative, you tend to lose.
Well, I don't think it's been a positive campaign. I think they made a strategic decision to run a positive convention
right. Because
they were concerned about how negative they'd been and that they'd get tagged with being negative. So they simply miscalculated about where to put their firepower. But even bigger than that, they miscalculated on what the message of the convention should be.
Well, Todd, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I guess I would just say that I would like to see what Todd says be true. I would like to see public financing. I would like to see an America where the parties could sit down, talk with each other, reason over bills. That's not what we're seeing. And the Republican Party, they're the ones running the country. So I guess I have to say that if you have to blame anyone, I would blame them. But thank you very much for coming on the show, Todd, and I hope we'll have you again sometime.
I hope so. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks. This is Mark Levine. I want to end with a quote by John Kerry, one of my favorites by him. He said it way back in 1971. He said, "Don't love your country right or wrong. That's like loving your mother drunk or sober. Love your country when it's right, and when it's wrong, make it right." This is Mark Levine.